Welcome to the Rise Network podcast show, a podcast dedicated to help you reach your dream lifestyle through investing in real estate. We're going to be sitting down with new, intermediate, and experienced investors to talk all about real estate and how it has changed their lives. If you're looking to scale your portfolio or even just get into real estate investing, you're in the right place. Make sure to tune in. Hello, hello, everyone. You are listening to the Rise Real Estate Investing Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. As usual, I'm here with who am I here with? I think they all know who you are. it's the long weekend right now. So this episode, we're going to take a little bit of a different approach. So we're going to give you kind of that preamble and updates on what's going on our end as per usual. But then later on, we're going to address a question that we get very often by newer investors and even some intermediate investors as well. And that is, what qualifies a good deal? But before we get into that topic, Mayu, how's everything going? I know you went down to Windsor yesterday, so let's talk about it.
Yeah, that was an interesting experience. So we've got some properties that we locked up the duplex. That one is half vacant, half tenanted. So I was just talking to the tenants, figuring out the renovation plan. Locked up single family, so went down with the JV partners on that. And we figured out the renovation plan. That one was a lot better condition than we thought it was in. So like really nice hardwood floors as soon as we go in. Completely messes up with like mine and Austin. Like our conventional like renovation plan, light gray walls, gray line of, what does LVP stand for?
Vinyl flooring.
Gray vinyl floorings, white cabinets, white backsplash. Like we just keep it cookie cutter, right? Like everything is the exact same for the majority of our properties. This one, they have beautiful brown hardwood floors, which completely messed up my entire color scheme. And I was like, shit, what do I do now? So now we got to try and find like matching LVP, and we're doing tiles and things like that. So it's a little bit different of like a renovation plan, but as long as it stays within.
Yeah. And how did we run across this deal actually? I don't think we discussed that in the podcast. Yeah. I mean, so for this deal, like property that was on the MLS that no one put an offer on for whatever reason, we got a pre-inspection report done, and it was an estate sale. And yeah, I mean, we were able to lock it up, and people are saying there's no deals on the MLS, but that was a pretty turnkey.
This one was actually under market. Like, so she had listed it at 229.
Yeah.
And it definitely should have gone way higher. Like this is very close to Tecumseh in the Walkerville area. Really should have, like, we're thinking ARV is going to be closer to like 300 ish or so in that area. Yeah. Pardon me?
Low 300s all day long once we do our renos.
Yeah, once we do our work on it. And so she had listed at 230, very fair asking price. The agent listed it as a 3-bedroom. I don't know why. It's actually a 4-bedroom. It's crazy though. Had knob and tube wire, but it needs a little bit of work, but it's actually a pretty good condition house. And we picked it up at 210 in the market where everyone's saying things are going 70 to 100K over asking and you know, things like that. We were still able to just act fast. We got in touch with her the night of offer date is when we first called her and we first looked at the pictures. And she was like, and so like when we talked to her, it's like, hey, like, are you guys open to preemptives? Like, is there an offer date, etc.? And she goes, yeah, offer date's today. And then it's like awkward silence. And then she goes, but we're still like open to options because we don't have any offers. And we're like,
well, if you don't have any offers, I need it. Yeah. So first thing, we're just like, okay, there's something wrong with the property. We need an inspection. Then she sent us a pre-inspection from the inspector that we literally use for majority of our inspections. So we trust and know this guy, right? And it just gave us a lot of confidence to move forward. We locked that up. We've had a lot of things going on in the back end. Acquisitions have definitely slowed down because we're focusing on trying to wrap our projects up. Mayu, you were dealing with and this is like a continuous timeline with every one of our podcasts, the fourplex with a lot of the troubled tenants, to say the least. Why don't you give the viewers a little update on that end?
Yeah, so when we bought this fourplex, it came with one unit empty. On closing day, it was still empty. I think what happened is we negotiated a cash for keys with one of the tenants, who then like they signed, they took the cash, they were like happy. And then they realized, you know what, like I'm leaving anyways, I'm just going to try and make as much money as I can. And now they are renting our upstairs vacant unit out by the bedroom to their squatter friends. Not the best tenant quality. and they're obviously not paying us rent. So that was kind of expected as well. So what we've done now is we call the cops basically periodically every few days whenever like our property manager or contractor lets us know that.
Honestly, even the cops are getting tired of the call. So last phone call, the cops were just like, what do you want? And they know.
Yeah. So we've got the internet put in. I couldn't leave the router there because I was like, if I leave this router there, someone's going to steal it.
Oh, so we're adding actually internet again to add security cameras. Someone's going to take that router.
Yeah, so you need the internet for the cameras to work. And so we added the internet in on Saturday, took a couple hours or whatever. And now the cameras, I'm delaying putting them in. And really it's because they're just going to break the cameras. Right, like they're going to break the cameras. It's the reality of what's going to happen here. So we are going to strategize a little bit about how to secure those cameras a little bit and make sure that no one can really access them. And then once you put the cameras in, it's just a game of calling the cops with evidence and saying, look, someone went in there, here you go, sending them the video footage, and hopefully they can make their arrests. And eventually people will get tired of it. But also the basement units or the main floor units vacating November 30th. So once they're out, we're going to be securing the asset from the front. So that means new doors. Most likely we're going to have to go with some sort of a gate on the door just to like kind of secure it. And we're going to have to do something about the windows as well for the time being until we turn around the units, get them rented out. And then now we control the tenant quality. There's people living there. So you don't have to worry about squatters and you can overall just turn around the building as a whole, right?
Yeah, that's the difficult part. I would recommend that kind of ties into our topic on what makes a good deal, because a lot of people who hear kind of the situation we're going through and how we're dealing with these squatters, calling the cops, need to install cameras, doesn't sound like a good deal to some people, but for us, it does sound like a good deal, right? Yeah. So today's topic, we're going to be talking about what is a good deal. Again, a question we get very often, very broad question. Me and Mayu have literally nothing planned in this conversation, so we're going to make it discussional and just kind of bounce ideas back and forth. This is kind of usually what we do on our strategy calls anyways, so you guys get a little bit of an insight on how we go about it. So Mayu, for you personally, what do you think is a good deal?
A strong cash on cash return, I think, is the simplest way I would put it. So a deal where you can significantly lift the value of the asset, therefore allowing you to pull out the equity, minimizing your cash investment. And then when you calculate your cash on cash return based on that net investment for over like the banger deals, man, we're sometimes over like 100% cash on cash return.
Yeah, that's not okay. That's a phenomenal deal.
Yeah. But you know, like at least over like 20-30% cash on cash return. To me, that means, you know, 3 to 4 years, I'm getting back all of my money at this point, and it's just going to continue to cash flow in perpetuity. I'm good with that as a rate of return. And then on top of cash flow, you're still getting equity pay down, price appreciation. So like not even including that, just pure cash flow based investing. To me, it comes down to the cash on cash return. What about you,
Ben? I want to chime in on that. I agree with you. Cash on cash return for us is extremely important, right? And again, I mean, if you ask anyone what's a good deal, it's going to vary from person to person. For me, my criteria, again, it's very aligned with my use. It's cash on cash return. If you guys don't know what that is, it's essentially what your net cash flow is, right? So basically your rental income minus every single expense of the property. And what are the expenses of the property? There's your mortgage payment, there's your utilities, there's your property taxes, your insurance. We even allocate 9 to 10% for vacancy and repairs. Even though that doesn't happen every single month, we allocate 9 to 10% to the rental income as those expenses, because let's be real, it's going to happen 1 year from now or 2 years from now, whenever, maybe a couple months from now, and that's going to be money coming out of your pocket. So what is your net yearly cash flow divided by your initial investment? How much money you put
in your net investment, not initial investment.
Yeah, sorry, your net investment. So for every dollar you put in the property, if your cash on cash return is 30%, you're getting 30 cents back. So for every dollar, I'm getting 30 cents back. And for me, that's very important, because interest, we're paying interest in cash every single month, right? Your equity pay down, it's not really in cash. It's equity, which we can't touch. So I want to know what my cash on cash return is, because that's going to be my return on my money in terms of cash liquidity, right?
Yeah. And if you're not someone with an abundance of capital, the cash on cash is what's going to let you continue to grow your portfolio, right? If you just leave 100K somewhere, The equity pay down is great. The price appreciation is great, whatever. But ultimately, like, you're not getting that 100K back. I mean, price appreciation is a different game and it's more speculation and things like that. But if you're not getting cash flow on that 100K, how are you going to buy the second one? How are you going to buy the third one? And from the bank's perspective as well, to keep lending to you as a customer, the cash on cash return really is what significantly impacts your your debt to service ratios as well, right?
Yeah. So let's dig into that one. Like that's a good discussion, right? Our cash on, like, the reason why we're cash flow investors is because it helps us with our borrowing capacity. So there's this little rule that we learned from our mortgage broker. Again, it's just kind of a rule of thumb. It doesn't apply to all the banks. I think it was actually Scotia and RBC more likely than any other bank. But essentially what it is that if your rental income is double your mortgage payment. So let's say I buy a house, my mortgage payment's 500 every single month. If I'm renting that same property out for $1,000, so that's double my mortgage payment, then that doesn't impact my borrowing capacity. I can qualify for another mortgage, right? So it becomes net neutral. And that's super important for people like us who are looking to scale, because I'm just thinking, Mayu, imagine we did this in big cities. You're not going to, like, even if it cash flows, it's not probably going to double your mortgage payment for a lot of these properties. You have a Scarborough property. Is it meeting that rule?
So the Scarborough property is okay. That one, it's okay because that one's under my wife's name. Her income is significant enough that it kind of outweighs the impact of that. But then if we added another, I think, two Scarborough bungalows, that's it. You're done. Three properties. You're not buying anything more than that ever, really, right? And so that's why, like, but with the Windsor portfolio, is like you're able to get to like 6 to 7 properties sometimes with a lender financing, even more sometimes I've heard, right? So, and that all just comes down to cash flow, right? Sure, they are smaller mortgages, but like if you're talking about a single family house, it's a smaller mortgage, right? My wife also has a set of 3 towns on her name. And the mortgage for that, like the purchase price is somewhere around 400. We're going to be refining it at close to like 550, 600 maybe. But that's still going to be significant enough to negate the impact of the mortgage, right? Like we're going to be refining at 550, but then we're going to eventually be able to get the rents up to about like 4,500 or something like that, or $5,000 or more, right? So then that's basically double the mortgage once again, right? So we can keep buying confidently.
So I guess that's actually a separate criteria, we could say. A separate criteria is that we want to get our rental income double our mortgage payment, or at least, at the very least, maybe around that 47-48%, right? So it won't necessarily be double. But yeah, that's another important criteria for scalability. Something that I did want to quickly touch on as well is that you know how earlier we were talking about cash on cash return. Our debt is so cheap right now. Like, what is it? Like, 2%, less than 2% for a 30-year mortgage, right?
Yeah.
And think about it like this, right? Like, if you can earn a cash on cash return greater than 2%, you are making money cash wise, right? Because if my cash on cash return is 10%, my interest is 2%, the difference between that's 8%. My yield is 8%, right? From a cash perspective, that's amazing. So I am taking advantage of these low interest rates all day long.
The one thing I will say is I don't think I've ever really looked at what is my mortgage interest rate. Like my very first property I did, probably the second one. Now I have no idea. Like my mortgage broker sends me the documents and I kind of sign, like trusting them and knowing who my agents are, that they'll get me a fair value. And like people will ask me all the time, like, hey, like, what are you getting? Like, oh, like who's your mortgage broker? And I'll give them the name and be like, contact them if you want someone. They'll be like, oh, what rate did he get you? I'm like, I have no freaking idea. Cause the difference to us between like a 2% and a 2.1, 2.2, like it's not going to materially impact us. And we're doing the BRRRR. So the first interest rate really has no significance. It's really the second if you really want to look into it. And the difference between a 2 and a 2.1 is just so negligible that like, it's fine. It's not going to make or break your deals. And if it does, you're doing something wrong.
Exactly. Like, what are your thoughts on buying something undervalued? Does the deal have to be undervalued on purchase or not necessarily?
Yeah. So this was a tough debate for me, right? It's like, do we focus on the cash flow or do we focus on the undervalue, like the wealth that we're building as a result of the deal? And it's a tough balance between the two, because we've bought deals that are almost turnkey, that are just significantly under market value. We'll basically just buy it, go back to the bank, like we'll do a little bit of like paint or something like that. And then we'll go back to the bank and be like, okay, can you appraise this? And they'll appraise this way higher than what we bought it for, right? So then you just refi it and you just move on with life, right? You're very minimally invested in the property. Now, the reality is when we're buying it under market value, the benefit of that is that it does allow for a strong cash on cash return and a very minimal investment, right? So I do think the two go hand in hand. But let's talk about the fourplex, right? So we bought that at 300. Yeah, 300. We're planning to spend somewhere around 100 to 125, I think, on that one. And then the lift in value that we're expecting there is about 100 to 150K, right? So is that's significant, right? Like there's no like easy way around it versus like when you're doing like a 20 to 30K lift in value, it's good. It's easy, whatever. But sometimes like it's really the cash on cash that matters in those cases.
Yeah, I think it's a tough question, right? Because again, you make money on the buy with a lot of these properties. And when you buy those turnkey under market properties, undervalued properties, there's only so much lift you can have. Because how undervalued is someone going to sell something that's relatively turnkey, maybe like 50 or 60K? And by the time you refinance it, you're still going to have a good amount of money tied into the property. But at least you're reassured that you bought it and you bought in at equity, right? So for us, again, like I like to just leave minimal amount of money tied in. And I believe you don't have to buy undervalued necessarily as well. So for us, with some of the properties that we purchased, I would say they were right at market value, but our renovations and kind of our vision and game plan of what are we going to do to drive value in this property is just as important. Because if you are very creative as an investor, for example, you look at Hamilton, you see a lot of these people buying properties at market value, but adding a secondary suite. So they're getting creative, right? And that's how they're lifting their value. That's another big portion that you need to look at. But for me, again, like this is all investor to investor. Each person has different preference. I prefer to buy something, again, where I'm leaving minimal amount of money tied in. So if I'm paying market's value for it, but I know my renovations are going to drive the ARV, the after repair value, up significantly, I'm totally okay with that. And besides, like if you're always just hunting for undervalued properties, I mean, it's gonna get to a point where it becomes like a bit difficult to scale, because you're going to be passing up on a lot of deals. Sorry, Maya, you're going to say something.
No, so I think what you're talking about is what's the best, what do they call it? Like the best purpose and use of the asset or something like that. Like there's a phrase for it.
Yeah. The highest and best use.
There you go. The highest and best use of the asset, right? So I love finding those deals where we're able to see a higher and better use than what the asset is currently being used for. So what usually in the markets that we play with right now, that is a single family house that can be converted into a student rental, right? Everyone else is looking at this single family house and they're thinking, okay, like we can get whatever, like $1,000 a month in rent. Me and Austin might look at it and go, yo, there's four bedrooms. It's within like 12 minutes of the university, like $500 a room. We can get about $2,000 in rent right on that. So we're re-envisioning the asset, and or we're going in there and we're saying, you know what, there's an untouched basement. Sure, it's a 3-bedroom student rental, but we can easily make this into a 6-bedroom student rental, significantly double our rents that from everyone else, right? So we're looking at things from a different perspective, and how can we efficiently maximize our total rents. The duplex that we just bought, 3 bedrooms upstairs, we're making that into a 4-bedroom very easily, right? So things like that. There was a JV partner was looking at a property out in Windsor the other day. It was a way oversized single family house. It's still on the market right now, but I think it'll be gone. But you know what? I'm not going to say the address just in case. Yeah. So they were looking at it. It was a way oversized single family house. I think it had 5 bedrooms or something like that as is. And there was still a lot of room, like untouched basement, et cetera. 13 minutes to the university. So, and they were thinking about running it as an illegal duplex, so non-conforming basement unit, instead of like taking on the additional risk. And that doesn't really impact your ARV. You're going to have to put in a brand new kitchen, all that stuff. I said, why don't you just add 2 bedrooms in the basement? You're now going from a 5-bedroom to 7-bedroom single family house. Your rents are basically going to be the same, if not higher, than if you ran an illegal basement unit. And you're within 12 to 13 minutes of the university, right? So it's just kind of thinking about what is the highest and best use for the asset. And then going from there.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what drives that's how you do the burr. That's what the burr comes down to. Actually, like on the topic of, because I know we're very particular about cash on cash return. That's one of our major metrics, right? Different investors will have different metrics. Some investors will look at the overall return on investment. So your return on investment's basically 3 criteria, right? Your cash on cash return. So basically your cash flow portion. The second portion is your equity pay down portion. And the third portion is your appreciation. And it depends on the importance you weigh about around each three of these, because I mean, there you can find a fine balance. You can get appreciation and cash on cash return, definitely. But there's always an argument between appreciation and cash flow, right? So for us, like any deal in Windsor, it might be considered a bad deal to Toronto investor, because their argument might be, well, you're investing in the outskirts, right? We're getting much stronger appreciation over your long term over the last 40 years than Windsor, right? And that's a totally fair argument, that we're where the major employers are, stuff like that. So it's all investor based as well, right? So for the cash flow and appreciation debate, Mayu, you invested in pretty high appreciating areas early in your investing career, right? On the east side, around the Durham region, also in Scarborough, you have a condo, Yonge and Eglinton. You've done both. You've literally done the straight appreciation route with some cash flow, right? Obviously, not crazy cash flow. And then you've also done the heavy Windsor region cash flowing properties. What are your thoughts on both of those, and which one do you lean towards more, and why? Or is it like a balance?
That's a whole other topic. Okay, so price appreciation is great in Toronto. Ultimately, without the price appreciation that happened.
Or let's not say Toronto in particular, just in general, okay. Because you can always argue between appreciation and cash flow. And that does qualify what's a good deal.
Yep. So price appreciation in general is great. It allowed me to build my portfolio to where it is today, right? Without a doubt, without the price appreciation, my growth would have been way slower. But what I will say is there is a limit on the amount of properties that you can get that are subject to price appreciation in these big cities, right? So it comes down to that DSR that we were talking about earlier. It comes down to like negative cash flows, break-even cash flows. Like how many of those can you really carry on your employment income? There's a cap on it, right? So let's just say a big city goes up by 10% year over year, and you can get to a max, like hypothetical examples here. Let's just say you can get $4 million in assets in a big city, right? Cool, that's great, whatever. So now we go on to the tertiary markets that are cash flowing markets. And let's just say those are only go up 5%. Okay, let's just say 5%. But if I can build out a portfolio of $8 million in a tertiary market that's cash flowing as well, like because your DSR is so much better, your cash flow is there, it allows you to build a steady, bigger portfolio. The 5% on a bigger pool of assets will be the same as the 10% on a smaller pool of assets, right? For less of a headache, less burden, stronger fundamentals behind it. And my other thesis behind it is price appreciation is great, but I think there's going to be a flock towards strong cash flowing assets, which is, we're already seeing it. It's seeing the price of these assets that do cash flow continue to increase, and people are eroding the cash flow margin on there. So it's foolish to think that like these tertiary markets are never going to appreciate in prices, right? A, everything's a ripple effect of a big city, at least in Canada, North America for the most part. B, people value these assets that are strong performing assets, right? They flock to them, and like housing is always going to be a strong asset. And I think it's been great, but you know, now moving forward, I intend to keep most of my assets in strong cash flowing assets so I can continue to grow a scalable portfolio. And I do think those value of those assets will increase. And the other thing I tell people is, you know what? Toronto is always in the market because housing market went up 100K year over year, right? So you're going from 1 million to 1.1 million, 100K price increase. Windsor's had, but 100K on a $1 million asset is a 10% year over year increase, right? Yeah. Windsor's basically had the same price year over year increase as well.
More. Even it's 30%.
Yeah. London has had a ridiculous rate of growth as well. Yeah. The difference is when you talk about a 400K asset and you say 10% year over year increase, it's 40K. The media is going to promote the headlines that are the most like sellable headlines, right? It's 100K year over year increase in Toronto. That's just a very sellable headline. But when you look at the percentage increase year over year, I think a lot of the other tertiary markets have now caught up and the price appreciation is there as well.
Yeah, totally agree. So from the appreciation versus the cash flow perspective, when I analyze a deal, the deal has to be good without appreciation, right? I do include 2% to 3% appreciation, because
That's inflation.
I do think real estate is going to move along with inflation. It'd be crazy if it's worth less in the future, because it's a hard tangible asset. They're not building any more land. But again, like the deal has to make sense without appreciation, unless it's forced appreciation. So forced appreciations, you're doing your rentals, you're bumping the value of the property up. That's sweet. That I have control of. I like having that. But natural appreciation, organic appreciation driven by market supply and demand. I mean, those factors are so fickle. They can change over time. They're susceptible to boom bust cycles. So how I like to say it is that, again, there are three levers in real estate. Equity pay down, you're going to get it in either market you choose, no matter where you go, as long as you rent the unit out. And then there's the cash flow and appreciation portion, right? So if you're investing in those bigger cities where most of the ROI comes from the appreciation, some of the ROI comes from equity, and it's negative ROI a lot of the times in cash on cash return, because they're getting negative cash flow every single month. So what happens if you change the appreciation by 1% down? Their ROI drops significantly, like five times the drop, right? The magnitude's huge. Whereas if you're looking in a small city or cities where they do have the cash flow fundamental, the majority of the cash, the ROI is driven by cash on cash return, some of it by ROE, and the minority is driven by appreciation, or at least how we analyze the deals. The minority would be driven by appreciation. So what happens if appreciation drops to 0%? Well, our ROI is still very strong because, again, we're getting that return on equity and that cash on cash return. So again, I keep on bringing down the point, but it depends on the particular investor. But for me, I like to have control in the asset, right? So if I have more control in driving the value of the asset, more control in driving the returns of the asset, that's what I consider a good deal, not a deal where I'm basically just relying on the supply and demand factors of that market.
Yeah. And so like so many people will message us asking, you know, like what is your idea of a good deal? Like, you know, random questions related to that. And the reality is it's very individual specific, right? Like if you don't feel comfortable investing 4 hours away, then Toronto's probably where you're going to find a good deal for you. Like what actually works for you? If your hourly rate in some sort of employment income or your other business that you're running is $1,000 an hour, frick, what are you doing investing in winter? That doesn't make sense. It's going to take you 4 hours to get there, 4 hours to get back. That's 8 hours. That's basically $8,000 within your time, right? So for everyone, like what is a good deal is significantly different. If you're sitting on $1 million in cash, you probably don't need to worry about reducing your net investment and stuff like that. You can play in a bigger market. There's variations. Everyone's very case specific. I think even when we talk about what's a good deal, right? Like I've got partners that are just like, you know what? I just want anything, right? So
just want a cash flow. That's it.
Yeah. I don't care if I'm right. And they don't care about how much money they're leaving in the asset. Right. So when they ask me, Mayu, what do you think about this deal? And I'd be like, no, like I'm not going to do that. Right. Because it doesn't work for me and what I think is a good deal. But they're just perfectly fine with leaving the money in there. And if that's the case, then, you know, what's a good deal for me might not. What's a good deal for you might still be a good deal just because it's not a good deal for me. Right.
Yeah. So it's important to ask yourself the question, like, what is your goal with real estate investing? Because if your goal is not to do what me and Maya are doing, which is scale as quickly as possible, then your good deal criteria would be maybe something that cash flows $1,000 a month, but you're leaving in 100K. You're still getting a 10% cash or cash return. You're getting 1,000 every single month in perpetuity. So that might be considered a good deal for you. Me and Mayu, we probably wouldn't do something like that at our level, right? Or if you have $1 million, as Mayu was saying, a good deal would be something that takes none of your time. So, yeah, I'll just collect something turnkey, fixer upper. No, that's not a good deal for me because that's a waste of my time. My dollars per hour is much better being spent at work. For someone like an investment banker or private equity, like that would make a lot of sense.
Even like doctors, right? If you're like a surgeon and like whatever, like we've come across those individuals. Like I know individuals that are like doctors like later on in life and like their hourly rate is pretty high. And they're just like, why would I want to like spend time like monitoring and renovating this property when I could just buy a turnkey, rent it out, and just like very like hands off, right? So for everyone, like the criteria is different. Me and Austin, our hourly rate, it's not like we really like monitor things at our hourly rate, but like we're growing our businesses. And so for us, it's really in and out as quick as possible. Pull out your capital, go on to the next one, right? Like that's really the focus area for us.
Yeah. And another big thing is you can always modify, right? So again, you got to ask yourself what's important. For us, we started off by saying minimal invested capital is important to us and then cash on cash return. But let me present this to you, Mayu. Let me hear your thoughts on this, okay? You got a single family home, right? Good deal. You renovate it, whatever. You burn it out, $5,000 tied in the property after all said and done. Cash flow is $100 a month.
Nah, not worth it.
$5,000 tied in, split between me and you, $2,500 tied in, $100 a month. Let's take on borrowing capacity out of this equation, okay?
Yeah.
For whatever reason, let's just say the borrowing capacity is completely fine, not an issue. So $2,500 tied in each, $100 cash flow, so $50 each. I mean, like that's an interesting proposition,
right? 25% cash on cash return, right?
Yeah. But like, just from a money tied in perspective, it's like, well, yeah. Shit, my return on equity and all of that.
That's true.
Pretty good.
and you know what? Like, it's also about like the headache, right? Like, is this a headache? Is it just we go in, vacant possession, we know exactly what we're going to do, we know exactly what contract we're going to use, and then we're just going to go get appraised. The comps are solid, the ARV is solid. There's no real risk there to us. Then like, yeah, okay, fine. You know what? Like, yeah, because we were having this debate when we were doing more duplexes, triplexes, quads. And then like we have people that want to do single families. We're like, okay, is that really the best utilization of our time given the cash flow is less and the returns are like, it's okay. Like it's a very easy, like whatever, like you're building like 30K in equity instead of like 100, right? So we had those discussions, but at the end of the day, like if it's an easy project, there's a return on time, right?
Yeah.
I think that's where you're going with that. If the return on time is justified, and like we're going to spend a couple hours on this deal just in and out, that's probably fine. And that can probably compare on a per hour basis to our fourplex where we're return on time, like time invested is a lot higher, returns a lot higher, as long as it's apple to apples. Yeah, I guess it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. But I'll be honest, Mayu, I think that is, would I do that deal? Maybe not. No, but I think that's a good deal. If someone bought that to me and be like, hey, Austin, look, $5K tied in, $100 cash flow a month, I would tell them to do it in a heartbeat because, man, like you're not leaving much money tied in. Again, your cash on cash return strong. 24% cash on cash return is not bad by any means. But is that like it's that return on equity that you're getting, that equity pay down? Yeah, some cash on cash return, but not much money tied in. If you guys learned anything from this, we hope you did. But it's basically everything just depends. Like that scenario I just spat out, like it didn't hit me and Maya's criteria, but we're looking at that deal like, man, that's still something that's pretty sweet.
Yeah. So with that being said, hopefully you guys got some value from these conversations. We try to change it up, and every now and then it'll be me and Austin just talking. And whenever we meet up and we mastermind and we just kind of like talk, our conversations are basically like this. They go in a full tangent on, we start off on something and we end up somewhere else. But hopefully, you know, we've heard some good feedback from people that they liked our conversations between me and Austin. So if you guys like this, make sure you like and subscribe. Share the podcast with whoever you want, whoever you can that's in your network, people that are looking at real estate, looking to get started, beginners, intermediates, experts.
Yeah, exactly what Mario was saying. We're always kind of trying out new ideas. So this is a bit different. We just wanted to take the discussion casual route, have nothing planned out, and just see where the conversation goes. If you enjoy it, please let us know and we'll keep this content up. If not, you'll never see an episode like this again. Don't worry. We're listening to you guys. But until next time, guys, invest smarter and live better.